72 degrees for both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg.
Welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's interview comes from the Morning Show Archives. We're going to spend the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show examining the difference between something that is real and something that is fake. And often, if we give that question any thought at all, we tend to think of a very distinct line between something that is real or authentic and something that is fake. And in fact, that line can be sort of fuzzy. And there are ways in which even something that is a fake or a forgery can be very real and authentic in its own right, particularly in certain arenas where sometimes fakery and forgery emerges on a relatively regular basis. I am so glad to be able to speak for the next few minutes with Lydia Pline about a fascinating book called Genuine Fakes: How Phony Things Teach Us About Real Stuff. And the fascinating realm of art forgery, as well as forgery and fakery that has occurred in field. Lydia Pline is a writer and a historian who is currently a visiting researcher at the Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. Her writing has appeared in many different places, including Atlantic Monthly, History Today, and Lady Science. And again, this book, which is published by Bloomsbury, is called Genuine Fakes: How Phony Things Teach Us About Real Stuff. Lydia Pline, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thank you.
I have really enjoyed this book, and one of the things that I think I enjoyed most about it is not just all of the fascinating stories that are here, but how just reading your book made me think about other stories of fakery and forgery that you don't take the time to address in your book, because there's not time for everything. But in some ways, I think that's maybe the highest compliment that one can pay to an author.
What I was thinking is, yeah, the idea that you sort of take it and look around and say, wow, here are all of these other genuine fakes. I love that.
Right. One that came to mind before we get to what's in your book is some year widely circulating that was supposedly a speech by Chief Seattle from sometime in the, I'm not sure if it was the 18th or 19th century, but apparently some kind of writing by Chief Seattle in which he said all kinds of beautiful things about the world around us and the need to preserve it. And it was just an environmentalist's dream to have a beautiful text like this. And it turned out to be a modern day hoax. And yet that's probably a pretty good example of what you were talking about in terms of something that actually has genuine worth in and of itself, even if it is not, in fact, what it was purported to be.
Yeah, and what I really find fascinating is the life that these things take on, sort of even after they've been debunked or even after they've been disproven or what have you. There's still this sort of question of, and then, like said, there's book.
So tell us what prompted you to want to explore this intriguing topic in such detail? Was there a particular story of forgery or fakery that made you realize that this would be fertile ground for a fascinating book?
Sure. So in my previous book, Seven Skeletons, I profile seven different famous fossil hominids, from Lucy to the Tang Child to a bunch of other ones. And one of the ones that I worked with real pieces of bone. It was discovered in 1912 and eventually completely debunked by the 1950s. It's one of the longest perpetrated hoaxes in the entire history of science. And the hoaxer today is still unknown. And so I really liked the story of the sort of mystery fake thing that was built out of real stuff. And I felt like that the real stuff to it really added some cachet to why the hoax was so successful. And so that was sort of the first example of a genuine fake that I started playing around with. And from there, as you say, you sort of went to heritage sites, wildlife documentaries, you name it, and there's a genuine fake to go with it.
Hmm. Let's talk about what you explore in your first chapter, which is titled, well, let's see. Actually, what we should really talk about, I think, right off the bat, because it's one of the most intriguing examples in the whole book, is what you talk about in the introduction. And that has to do with some works that were created well after the death of American artist Andy Warhol. And at a quick glance, it would seem that there would be no way in the world for an actual piece of art by Andy Warhol to be created after his death. And yet you share with us an intriguing story of something that is very nearly that.
Yeah. So as you point out, Andy Warhol, you know, technically died in 1987. And has sort of left this huge legacy in the world of art, obviously. And in 2010, the artist Paul Stevenson came across 10 original Warhol acetates from the mid-20th century. These are silkscreening negatives that Warhol had used to make his art. And when he buys the acetates, there's still paint from Warhol that's on the acetates. And Stevenson works with several specialists and several curators who had worked with Warhol himself and wanted to sort of reignite the acetates, reuse them to be able to create additional works that were very much in the spirit of Warhol and very much using all of the same materials and same technique, like actually physically the same stuff that Warhol had done. And Stevenson is very careful in what he's doing to not say, you know, oh, these are Warhols from the mid-20th century. And so there's not this element of deception or fraud or deceit that you would generally associate with, you know, fake art or fraudulent art. But Stevenson sort of is posing this question of, could you extend the legacy? If we have all of these elements that Warhol uses and Warhol makes, and it's, you know, following all of these same things that Warhol does, could these be Warhols, but just 21st century Warhols? And I think the jury is still out as to whether or not, you know, we would accept them or whether the art world accepts them. And I like that.
You say picking through the complicated stories of genuine fakes ensures that questions of authenticity and authorship are asked and answered and asked again. I guess part of what you're saying there is that we need stories like this to help us think about what is it that is real and what does it mean when something is actually fake, and where is that line, and can that line sometimes be blurred?
I agree, definitely. But I would also add that when I sort of talk about when it's asked and asked again, one of the things that is...
and something that he reflects upon after a visit overseas. Tell our listeners about this. I think this feeds nicely into what we were just talking about.
Right. So so in the 1860s, Mark Twain visits Europe, goes through, sees a bunch of different reliquaries, sees all of the different sort of cathedrals and reliquaries and saints, and all of these things that are, you know, very much part of this European sort of religious cultural heritage. And when he writes The Innocents Abroad, which is his description, to say that even if we might have a second saint or a third saint, or, you know, however many that all of these bones add up to, they still carry a cultural cachet and that there's value in that. And so I think that even though Twain offers this brilliant sort of quip that there's a lot of nuance. He's willing to accept the nuance of the objects that he's looking at.
One of the things that we are also reminded of, not only in this introduction, but in just about every chapter that follows thereafter, is that in many cases, something that is some sort of a forgery or fake so often is feeding a fervent desire that we have for something we are looking at to be, in fact, what it purports to be. I'm reminded of visiting a small little museum in Spillville, Iowa, where a Czech composer named Antonín Dvořák, small museum in the top with all kinds of curiosities. And the thing I remember most vividly is that in one of these cases is supposedly one of the wheels off of the little bassinet in which the Lindbergh baby slept before the baby was kidnapped. And of course, you know, you see this object there, and it's one of, you know, hundreds of objects in this room, and you realize there is no way by now to know if this is true, if that in fact is what that is, or if somebody bought that, you know, 100 years earlier thinking it was true or whatever. But you look at it and you want it to be true. and that very desire is part of what, of course, makes all of this a bit cloudy and makes us sometimes susceptible to jumping to conclusions about whether or not something is authentic or not.
Right. It sort of feels like it has just enough pull and sort of speaks to what we want it to be true, that can carry an awful lot of sort of staying power. It reminds me of the quote, the twist again, and the really beautiful bit of sort of historical irony with that is we're not sure whether or not Petronius actually says that, but its sentiment sort of still stands. It's sort of, again, all the way down.
Good point. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Lydia Pine, and we are talking about her a very intriguing book called Genuine Fakes, How Phony Things Teach Us About Real Stuff. Early in the book, you talk a little bit about why you chose the particular fakes and forgeries that you did. And there's a very real reason and valid reason why, for instance, the fake diary of Adolf Hitler that made headlines a few decades ago, that's not here. Would be most interesting to talk about. Briefly explain to our listeners what ended up helping you choose the particular.
I think in one iteration there were something like 25 or 30 different chapters, and a very kind editor looked at that and said, "There's no way you can't do that. People will need a forklift to try and, you know, move this book." So in some sense that was a huge sense of needing to trim down some ideas. But I also wanted to pick objects that I felt asked the questions about authenticity in different ways. So, for example, how we think about authenticity in the world of diamonds and laboratory-grown diamonds is very different than how we think about authenticity in terms of wildlife documentaries. And that's very different than how we think about authenticity in terms of archaeological heritage sites. And so I wanted to pick objects that I felt were thematically very separate and could really sort of encourage readers to say, oh, this is a really cool example of this. Wait, that's just like X or Y or Z. And so to sort of offer that as a starting point to go find other genuine fakes.
Let's talk about some of the very intriguing stories that we find in your book. And I had not known at all forger. And one of the reasons we refer to this person as the Spanish forger is that their specific identity, extraordinary. Tell our listeners about the Spanish forger.
I loved delving into the story of the Spanish forger. I think that I know I'm not supposed to have favorite stories that have come out of this project, but that would have to rank right up there as one of my favorites. So the Spanish forger was an art forger who was very active at the turn of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, and painted a lot of sort of faux medieval scenes. There were lots of women in these sort of fancy dresses, knights and dragons and castles, and very much sort of what you would think of as iconic medieval sorts of pieces. He painted wood panels, medieval manuscripts. He would repurpose different manuscript leaves to do miniatures. It's sort of anywhere and everywhere that you would expect this kind of medieval art to show up. The Spanish forger definitely has a finger on the pulse of that kind of art market. So the Spanish forger is very successful, places his art in lots of different ways. It's collected by numerous institutions right up until 1930, when J.P. Morgan Library in New York and asks her to authenticate it, that the Met had already authenticated it, and asks Green to authenticate it as well. And Green spent some time looking at this and studying it, and something is just off. It's just not quite right. And as she sort of starts to pick through the details, she realizes that it's just too medieval looking. Like, it just has too many things that are too perfect. After her study, she realizes that this is not from the Middle Ages, that it's not a medieval painting, that it is sort of turn of the 20th century, and calls the artist the Spanish forger, because she had been authenticating a work by a Spanish artist and had thought that might follow. But as you point out, the Spanish forger has never had an identity put to their work. Specialists and scholars don't know whether this artist was actually Spanish. They don't know whether it was a man, whether it was a woman. They don't know sort of how long the artist had been working. There's a lot of sort of mystery and intrigue tied up in this story. And eventually, Bel de Costa Green, the librarian, puts together a sort of extensive collection and catalog of the Spanish forger's work. And today, the Spanish forger is actually highly collectible as the Spanish forger, which is sort of this, again, this beautiful twist to a story like that.
Hmm. One of the things I found especially fascinating was to read about the kind of tiny details that one eventually could look for in such a...
It's like knowing how a magic trick is done. Once you know sort of what to look for, it's very clear. But until you know what to look for, it doesn't sort of raise the sort of skepticism or raise any concerns. And it was funny to have studied all of the different tells and to say, oh, I had been very prepared to just very arrogantly dismiss it of, oh, look, I can see, even I can see all of these tells, like how obvious this is. And it was interesting. And it was a very humbling experience to see the pieces in person.
And you say that these are obviously the work of a brilliant artist, and they are brilliant and beautiful in their own right, even if they are not what they were purported to be originally.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the reason, that and the sort of, as we've talked to it, I think is one of the reasons that they have become so collectible as genuine Spanish forgers.
Hmm. That chapter is also taken up with a forger who actually I did know something about, but I certainly learned more in reading your book, one William Henry Ireland. Not an artist, but actually a writer of great talent. Tell our listeners about his escapade in forgery in the late 18th century and how convincing his work turned out to be.
The story of William Henry Ireland is fantastic. So William Henry Ireland in the late 18th century is 18 years old. He's desperate to impress his father, who's this sort of middling collector of rare books and manuscripts, and to respect him more if he's able to sort of come across a Shakespearean signature and sort of offer that to his father to add to his father's collection. So William Henry Ireland obviously isn't going to find a genuine Shakespeare signature, so he just makes one. He forges one. He gives it to his father, sort of presents it as, oh, I found this. Look, Dad, isn't this amazing? And his father says, yes, this is fantastic. It's brilliant. It's wonderful. He buys it as the real thing, completely sort of hook, line, and sinker. And William Henry Ireland sort of takes that affirmation and starts creating other Shakespearean forgeries. So everything from land deeds to family Bibles, William Henry Ireland ensures that that William Henry, that Shakespeare's signature pops up. There's even a play that William Henry Ireland writes sort of under the name of Shakespeare that's by all accounts atrocious. And his father buys it. And William Henry Ireland has a good run, about 18 months. And then scholars start to examine the works and really pretty quickly debunk this as genuine Shakespeare. And William Henry Ireland capitulates pretty quickly, folds really fast, and says, yep, you're right, I faked it. At the end of his life, in sort of later decades of his life, he begins forging his original Shakespeare forgeries and selling them as his original forgeries to sort of help himself out with his money trouble, financial value, what have you. That it was worth it to William Henry Ireland to make them again, to just sort of keep on forging. And that is, I really love the twist to that story.
Absolutely. I also think another aspect of this story that is worth exploring, as you do in your book, is the relationship between William Henry Ireland and his father Samuel, and his father's reluctance to believe his son's confession.
Yeah, that on some level the hoax is so good, or the belief of his father is so in the forgeries is so committed that Samuel sort of goes to his grave believing that he's bought the original, you know, the stuff that what William Henry Ireland forged was in fact buy into.
We're speaking with Lydia Pine, and we're talking about her fascinating book called Genuine Fakes: How Phony Things Teach Us About Real Stuff. I think I especially enjoyed the chapter called The Truth About Lying Stones, because just a few days ago I had a local paleontologist on this very program. And so it was very, very interesting to read this instance of fake fossils and about what in many respects is kind of a sad story around one Dr. Johann Bartholomew Adam Berenger. Tell our listeners about Dr. Berenger and the way in which a hoax was foisted.
Berenger was a fairly insufferable person, and so his colleagues at the university, two of his colleagues, decide that they're going to take him down a peg or two, that they've just had enough and that they're just going to sort of put Berenger in his place. And so these two colleagues spend considerable amount of time carving these quote-unquote fossils. And when you see them, they're really hilarious. They're everything from little, like, you know, dancing worms with smiley faces to suns that have smiley faces as well. There are, you know, sort of anything and everything. And it's very easy to sort of look at them, especially in the 21st century, and to say, how could you ever think that these are fossils? But he does. Berenger does. He buys them hook, line, and sinker, and he creates this monograph. The hoax kind of gets carried away. It sort of spins out of control until eventually somebody explains to Berenger that he's been duped. And Berenger promptly turns around and sues his colleagues for besmirching his good name. The court transcripts are hilarious. And that's that. And I was really curious about what happened to these fake fossils, these lying stones, as they came to be known. What happened to them after they're debunked? And it turns out that, you know, hundreds of five, and they can inform people about the hoax, but also about how people were thinking about fossils at the beginning of the 18th century. And again, I love that sort of sense of what happens to the object after it's been declared a fake and after the hoax has been debunked. And so it really, I felt, spoke to the story of the material life of the object.
Right. In other words, one might assume that once we knew that these were just fakes that somebody created in what was amounted to almost kind of a cruel practical joke, that once that was revealed, well, then why wouldn't you just fakes, and that they took on a life of their own gives them a worth that goes well beyond the fact that they're fakes.
Exactly. And it felt like that was one of
all kinds of interesting things in this particular chapter. But one of the things that you explore a bit is the very nature of fossils themselves and how, in a sense, they are the kind of thing that might be where it might be very, very tempting to do this kind of thing and to jump to conclusions about what a given fossil, in fact, is. You write at one point, part of the mystery of these natural objects comes from their inherently fragmentary nature, and that mystique certainly surrounds fossils today. It is rare for an entire organism to be perfectly preserved. Bones can get trampled on and buried over time, and for a fossil to be captured exactly in situ, the perfect circumstances of geology, geomorphology, and taphonomy need to be available. So because of the fragmentary nature of the fossil record, the whole story of an organism is not preserved, just as the whole organism is rarely found. It is a partial remains. I'd never really stopped to think about that fossils, by their very nature, tend to be an incomplete story in and of themselves. And it makes it all the more important that they be treated carefully and with scientific rigor.
Exactly. That they're sort of that we're fronted with these objects that are incomplete. And the question of how do we fill in, how do we sort of string them together, how do we make them into something, requires interpretation. And with that interpretation, we can have everything from really great, sort of everything from the gamut to the Piltdown hoax or to Beringer's lying stones. And so I think that there are a lot of really interesting cautionary tales that are sort of scattered throughout history with the stories of fossils.
Hmm. That reminds me of a later chapter in your book, Chapter 8, which talks about a spectacular cave that was discovered not long ago, I think back in the mid-1990s. And a cave with prehistoric paintings so spectacular that the decision by the powers that be was made very quickly that this cave can never be opened to the public. I think ahead of just talking about this newly discovered cave, would be interesting to talk about an earlier cave discovered in France that ended up being all but destroyed inadvertently when it was opened to the public. This is a cautionary tale which led to a very different decision being made.
In Europe, if you're familiar with sort of the Paleolithic bowls or things like that, those are coming from the Lascaux Cave and motifs like that. But Paleolithic art, by its nature, is very delicate. It's not art that you can pick up and move to ideal gallery conditions the way we can move stuff in museums. That because it's part of the natural world, it is subject to sort of the natural, the sort of quote-unquote problems with nature. And so it is impermanent. And so when we have hundreds of thousands of tourists that are going through and looking at the art, it creates a sort of petri dish, actually. And so the art ends up being destroyed by bacteria, by lichens, by all of the sort of trampling of people going through it. It really becomes an example where the art is destroyed simply by the act of viewing it. Even if people are very respectful and really careful, simply introducing the human presence to the art destroys it. And Lascaux Cave, as you point out, really was basically spent over the course of the 20th century, and a lot of the art was destroyed. And today it's very heavily regulated and very heavily monitored and to try and sort of stop some of the decay. And so certainly Lascaux has been this cautionary tale for finding ways for people to be able to see and learn about Paleolithic art without sort of putting the art at risk. And so when Chavez Cave was discovered in the mid-1990s, there was never any question as to whether or not people would be allowed to go into it. They wouldn't because of what had happened to Lascaux. And so a really fantastic replica of the cave, of Chavez Cave, was built. And there have been replicas that were built as a way of protecting and saving art.
Hmm. We're speaking with Lydia Pine of her, and we will only be able to touch on just a bit of what is found here. And on what you talk about in chapter 5 of your book, which is called Taking a Look Through the Walrus Cam. This takes the matter of fakery in kind of a different direction as you explore the long and intriguing legacy of wildlife films. First of all, explain to our listeners what the walrus cam is. This is something I didn't know anything about until reading your book, although I've explored things like it. But tell our listeners about the walrus cam and what an exciting discovery it was for many people.
Sure. So walrus cam is a live stream camera that is set up in Alaska. And over the course of the summer months, when walruses migrate to Alaska, it basically live streams two different beaches where walruses haul out. And you can tune in and watch the walruses do their walrus thing. You can watch them sort of walk around the beach, coming in and out of the water. You can see, well, at some points during the day, there aren't a lot of walruses. And it really just sort of feels like opening a window to look at the walruses. The walrus cam is run by the Alaska Game and Fish Department in conjunction with Explore.org, the same organization that runs Bear Cam, which is pretty well known. And I love this sense of, you know, it's how you think that you would see nature if only you were there, that if only I could transport myself to the sanctuary islands in Alaska, I would be able to see the walruses just how I'm seeing them here. And so it offers this really unscripted, unencumbered, unnarrated way of looking at nature.
And that is in stark contrast to much of what is seen in wildlife films and documentaries. Explain how that is actually kind of a remarkable exercise in fakery, if one wants to kind of look at it in those terms.
Right. So when we look at the giant blockbuster wildlife documentaries, we see wildlife filmmakers really finding footage and finding stories that are going to teach their audience something, whether it's teaching them about nature, helping them understand more about the animals, that there's a script, that there's a sense of what the film is supposed to, quote-unquote, do for its audience. And so with that, there's sort of a push to get spectacular shots and to have spectacular footage. In zoos or other sorts of ways that we might consider sort of a bit of artifice rather than this isn't just somebody sitting out on the ocean waiting for this particularly awesome shot or something like that. And so there's very much a sense of scripting the experience and scripting the story. And there are, I want to emphasize that there are very good reasons to do that, but it's not sort of the same way of I'm just opening my window and looking out at nature, and nature, here is nature performing for me. And that's a very stark contrast to the wildlife cameras.
Right, exactly, where what you see is what you get, and what you get might not be very much that particular
right,
day.
That, you know, exactly, that at some level you have to sort of say, well, you know, I've been watching for half an hour, and there aren't any walruses on the beach. I guess nobody's coming to the beach today. But that doesn't make for sort of exciting or gripping blockbuster documentary making.
Right. And, of course, I think, really do a nice job of kind of exploring this conundrum that is faced by those who create these wildlife films. I mean, they are not out to deceive anybody.
No, but
they're anxious to tell a story. You say this is where filmmakers are engaged in a delicate tango of blending art and artifice into and ever evolving expectations.
Yeah, and I think the you know, that's a better way, or that watching nature that way helps us understand, you know, more about the animals as they really are. But then you're left realizing, unless you're an expert about those animals, it's very easy to not understand what you're looking at. And so a wildlife documentary, even though it's sort of blending this art and artifice and sort of script telling, it's able to impart to you something that you might not know before. And so again, there's this sort of trade-off that both are authentic, but they have different requirements for authenticity.
Speaking of the word authenticity and the related term authentication, the show that we all know called Antiques Roadshow, but goes on to talk about a certain Mayan artifact that has had a very, very interesting story of its own that really speaks to a lot of what we've been talking about today.
Right. So the Gwalior Codex is the Maya artifact that you're talking about. And for decades, the Gwalior Codex was thought to be fake, was thought to be this sort of hokey thing that nobody could really authenticate. A codex is a Maya book, and there are very, very few of them that have survived from the 15th century onward. And there are only three other Maya codices that are known to be in existence. And so the idea of finding another Maya codex was really rare. It really sort of piqued that too good to be true kind of tingly feeling that people have. And so for decades, and it really wasn't accepted by the majority of archaeologists and Maya scholars. And it's not until the 21st century that a very serious battery of tests and authentication processes were run on the codex, and it is considered an authentic artifact now. There's still some detractors, but by and large, often when we're talking about fakes and less than genuine things, we talk about them being debunked, or we talk about them being proven wrong, or sort of unmasking them. And I love the story of the codex because it shows us that authenticity is a continuum, and it's possible for objects to move up and down that continuum, that it's not enough for something to just be debunked. It's that things can be authenticated as well.
I think it would be interesting for us to, in a sense, end where we began, or towards the beginning of our interview anyway. We talked about the Spanish forger and writer William Henry Ireland. And those two figures in this history of famous forgeries are talked about within the context of something called the Stuart B. Schimmel Forgery Collection, which is such an interesting idea, just on the surface of it. Explain to our listeners what this is and, in a sense, what this has to do with the heart and soul of this book.
Sure. So the collection you're referring to was put together by Stuart Schimmel, who's a 20th century collector who collected genuine fakes, that he was only interested in collecting the most genuine of forgeries. He had everything from that you have a collection that is built out of only genuine fakes, barely just the quote-unquote real or just the quote-unquote authentic things. It's that both of those characteristics can be defined and redefined to the point where you have somebody like Stuart Schimmel who has this amazing collection of fakes. And I feel like that, as you point out, it really is sort of one of the major themes that I wanted to explore painting, or, you know, all of these other fakes, when that they can have a life that's more than just them being fake, that they can turn around decades and centuries later and be collectible and quote unquote real in their own ways.
Well, as I said, we have just scratched the surface of all that is in your fascinating book, which is again titled Genuine Fakes, How Phony Things Teach Us About Real Stuff, published by Bloomsbury Sigma. And I do want to mention that the book includes some wonderful photographs, including photographs of a couple of the so-called lying stones, the fake fossils that fooled Dr. Johann Berenger. We have some of the beautiful work of the so-called Spanish forger, and much, much more. The author of this book, Lydia Pine. Lydia Pine, thank you so much, first of all, for creating such a fascinating book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. I've really enjoyed this.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Tomorrow, Saturday, in the podcast version of The Morning Show, something out of the archives from the 1990s, a real-life story of heroism. It's the interview that I recorded with a young man by the name of Casey Holtz, who actually dove into the waters of Lake Michigan to rescue a little boy named Jacob who was drowning. This was a story that was covered by the Kenosha News, and I was able to track down this young man and do an interview with him to get his description of what exactly happened. We're dusting off this interview and sharing it in the podcast version of The Morning Show tomorrow. If you want to hear it, then you need to seek out the podcast version of The Morning Show, which is under the title The Morning Show with Greg Berg, available